Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to our Super Groovy Thursday Open Forum show here at Catholic Answers Live. It's super groovy because we'll play the groovy music later, and it's open forum because any question that you have about the Catholic faith, about Catholic morals, about the philosophy and ideas that underlie the Catholic faith, maybe it's something we do that you want to know why we do it, something we believe, you want to know why we believe that, give us a call.
Why water expands when it freezes?
That was for the pre-show.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, we already did that one. Okay.
888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. I do want to stress as well that you don't have to be Catholic to call. If you're curious about something you heard about Catholics, for one thing, I should say, you're not going to offend us. The question is not going to offend us. If you got something you want to know about the Catholic faith, we'd love to try to address it.
The question won't offend us, but be nice.
Okay, yeah.
We want to be nice here. Have a nice discussion.
Yeah, but I sometimes think about the person who's like, oh, you know, Catholics worship Mary. And I don't know if that would offend them if I asked them about that. You know,
no,
but
that doesn't offend. Questions do not offend.
And we don't worship Mary, by the way.
No, we don't.
Again, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Our guest is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, Si?
I'm doing very, very well. And you are also the author of The Drama of Salvation, which is... Mm-hmm. That's the current title, right?
Yes.
It used to be.
It's an expanded version of another book, but the current souped up, new and improved version is The Drama of Salvation.
Right. And yesterday, Trent was talking about The Drama of Salvation with a caller.
Oh.
Because I think the caller wanted to know, how are we saved?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the Catholic Church? Oh, no, you know what the caller said was, often Protestant evangelization efforts are easier than he felt they were for him as a Catholic because they had simple formulas and it was hard. And so Trent was explaining how you had talked
offered
about
a simple formula.
Yeah, kind of a simple formula for what do you need to do to be saved, in other words?
Repent, believe, and be baptized.
Amen, brother.
And if you commit a mortal sin, repent, believe, and go to confession.
All right. But you're also the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist.
Yeah.
The first in a series of Daily Defense books.
Well, hopefully at least two. But there will be other 365 books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Looking to do one like 365 days on the Bible and stuff like that.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. How is that not done already? You are Jimmy Akin. You could do 365 days on the Bible.
I'm working on another book right now,
which
is about
right.
understanding the teaching of the magisterium.
Yeah. Yeah. I've spoken to you. I don't know if we've ever spoken that on the air, about that on the air, but we have spoken about it.
We mentioned it a little, but that's about it.
But that's a real, the underlying question there is, how do you know how authoritative some statement from the church is?
Right.
Right.
How to correctly interpret and weigh statements in church documents.
Right. Mm-hmm. So like often it'll, you know, some, I don't know, bishop at the Vatican will say something and it gets reported in the news like the Vatican said, and I think that's interpreted as if like, this is Catholic teaching.
Usually that means that someone at the McDonald's nearest the Vatican said something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right. And so those are not really authoritative statements if it's at the McDonald's nearest the Vatican.
No,
That's not even a level of authority.
No, I mean, not unless they're telling you how much you need to pay for a cheeseburger.
Well, I imagine it's very subtle and everything, but is there a way to say what the highest level of authority is? Like, could you?
Well, okay, so in terms of authority, there's sort of two axes, two ways in which you need to measure something. The first one is how certain is it? And certainty tops out at absolutely certain. But then there's also there are additional factors that play into it, one of which is it divinely revealed? And so and obviously things that are divinely revealed could be considered more authoritative than things that aren't, even if they're equally certain. If God himself said something, that kind of lends it an authority,
right?
As opposed to if you just figured it out and happened to be right.
Yeah.
So when you have both of these things together, when something's both infallibly certain and divinely revealed, it's what's called a dogma.
Okay.
And it has to be both of those to be a dogma. It has to be both divinely revealed and infallibly taught by the church as divinely revealed. And when those two happen, that's the highest form of church teaching is a dogma.
And that would be something like the bodily resurrection of Jesus.
Sure.
Like that's
– yeah.
And there
are other things, though, that are infallible but not necessarily divinely revealed.
Okay.
And so the church can exercise its infallibility even on some things that aren't direct divine revelation.
So if I said, like some modern people say, well, I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, but I don't know if it was a bodily resurrection. It could have been a spiritual experience that the apostles had or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, am I – like I'm officially outside the teaching of the church then, right? Like,
if you say it's not bodily, yes.
Okay.
Now, if you're – because it definitely involved his body.
Yeah.
There are additional questions. Like sometimes people want to use the term physical. Is it a physical resurrection? And there it's a little trickier because the Greek word phusis, which is where we get the word physical, means natural.
Oh.
And I mean that's what phusis is in Greek, is nature.
Uh-huh.
And so there you could raise a question of, well, okay, exactly what do you mean here by physical? Because if you mean that he naturally resurrected, well, no, he didn't naturally resurrect. It was supernatural.
Yeah.
So you kind of got to be careful with some of these fine distinctions. But the fact Jesus was bodily resurrected, that's a dogma.
Again, our number 888-318-7884. If you have a question for Jimmy Akin, it is open forum today, meaning whether you are Catholic or not, your call is welcome. I think on most days we welcome calls from Catholics or not. I guess some days we're more specific. And whatever your question has to do about the Catholic faith, we welcome that. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, seriously, it feels like we just started the show and every line is full.
Hey.
I feel like go right to those phones. How do you feel about
that? Let's do that.
Michael in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hey, hello, Jimmy and Cy. My question has to do with Genesis 9:22,
okay.
It's the part where it says, "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, mm-hmm. and told his two brothers outside." I was talking to a friend about that recently, and I told her that I didn't think the church has a deep explanation or understanding of that or what that means, and she told me that she'd heard that there was, and that it had to do, it dealt with some maybe possibly an incestuous relationship of that son or something like that. So mm-hmm. I wanted to get Jimmy's thoughts and explanation of that.
It's
that line in the Bible.
It's a mysterious passage. The church doesn't have an official teaching on what it means. That leaves that up to biblical scholars. If you take the text in a fairly straightforward way, in perhaps the most just straightforward way, it would mean that, well, Noah got drunk and he was laying around the house naked after he got drunk because, and reading it charitably, some people have suggested he didn't know the effect that the grapes were going to have. But we don't have good evidence that grapes operated differently before the flood than afterwards, so he may well have known. But in any event, he gets drunk and he's laying around the house naked afterwards, and his grandson comes in and sees him naked and then basically goes off and gossips about it and thus brings shame upon him. And so the other two sons who hear about this go in and they walk backwards with a blanket to cover up Noah so they don't see his nakedness, and they take away the cause for his shame by covering him up. That's the most straightforward way to read the passage. That's what it seems to mean when you read it on the surface. A lot of people down through history, though, have said this is really strange, and there may be something more going on in this passage. The passage may be using euphemisms. Euphemisms are where you use language that kind of cloaks a less pleasant reality with a more pleasant phrase, or more socially acceptable phrase. Like, you know, back during the 70s, it was a big thing to talk about making love, when what you meant was having sex.
Yeah.
And having sex is much more blunt. And then there are even much more blunt terms that we won't use here than having sex.
Appreciate that, Jimmy.
So there's a range of different registers that one can communicate in.
Right.
And some people have said, well, here in this passage, the biblical author is using a euphemism to sound or express politely something that was worse than just seeing granddad naked. So that raises the question, well, what might this be? Two suggestions occur to me off the top of my head. One of them is because someone's – in Hebrew, they have a phrase where they refer to somebody's nakedness as their lawfully wedded spouse in union with them. So if you – so there are various passages later on in the Pentateuch, in the first five books of the Bible, where it'll say things like, don't have sex with your aunt because she is your uncle's nakedness.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh.
And so it's like those two people are naked together, so they share a nakedness.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, when grandson goes in, sees Noah's nakedness, could mean he saw Noah making love to his wife.
I see.
And then went off and gossiped about it. And so that could be part of it. Also, and then there's the other one, which, Michael, you mentioned, some people have suggested that actually he went in and had an incestuous sexual act with Noah, not in his right mind because he's drunk and so he doesn't know what he's doing, and then went off and dishonored him further by talking about it. And so those are kind of three possibilities. Like I said, the church doesn't have a teaching there. It's perfectly acceptable to take this in the straightforward way of saw Noah naked and then went off and gossiped. But these others are certainly possibilities that people have proposed and they could be correct. But there's no certainty here.
Michael, thanks very much for starting us off today on Open Forum. We have to take a break right now. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hi, this is Tim Staples, and I'm challenging you to take the 20 Answers Challenge. Here's how the challenge works. When you purchase the sampler of all 26 books in the 20 Answers series, we're going to knock 60% off the price, and we're challenging you to finish them all this Lent and Easter season. And this year, to make it easier, we're offering free shipping on the sampler if you live in the continental United States. That's 60% off free shipping and over 500 answers to questions you have about the Catholic faith. Join us this Lent and Easter to take the 20 Answers Challenge, and together we can be part of something great. Call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com now to get your set and begin taking the 20 Answers Challenge today.
We struggle with sin. We're distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. Thankfully, the Church has given us Lent, the perfect time for reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. The saints of the Counter-Reformation faced greater obstacles than these, yet they found the grace to persevere during a tumultuous period in the Church. How can we do the same? Reform Yourself is a great place to start. We all need to reform our souls. This Lent, let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, also a prolific author. And among his writings are two of the 20 Answers books in the Catholic Answers 20 Answers collection. He has 20 Answers Bible Prophecy and 20 Answers Salvation. I mention those, Jimmy, because I want to remind people that all of them are on sale right
now. That's right.
The entire pile that we have in front of us, 26 books.
Absolutely. The 20 Answers Challenge sale has been so popular, we've been having to pull in extra people who aren't even in shipping to box them all up to get them ready to ship out.
I noticed that in the library, there's just stacks of these books in there.
So very popular. Get them while we have them.
It says here more than 950 people already accepted this challenge. The way it works is 60% off to get all 26 books. Each book contains 20 answers on a different topic, whether it's the Reformation or the real Jesus or the church or salvation or Bible prophecies or any number of things. And what we challenge you to do, giving you 60% off, is try to have them all read by the end of the Easter season, which is May 20th. In addition to them being 60% off, there is no shipping charge while this challenge lasts. We're going to ship them to you for free. So you just pay 40% of the cost of these books and you get them shipped to you for free. You get it all at shop.catholic.com. Go to shop.catholic.com and join the 20 Answers Challenge today. You will be among many people who have undertaken that. 888-318-7884, our number here. Jimmy, we go now to Devante in Odessa, Texas. Devante is smart because Catholic Answers Live app. Everyone should have the Catholic Answers Live app. Devante, your question for Jimmy.
How are you guys doing today?
Really good. Thank you.
Yes, I was watching a podcast on YouTube where the gentleman was talking about the ancient African Christian church, and he started talking about church fathers who were non-Greek and non-Latin speaking.
Okay.
And he listed like Shenouda and Ephraim the Syrian, but I had never, I just assumed all the church fathers were Greek and Latin speaking. Do you have any examples of like said fathers?
Well, you actually mentioned one of the first ones that comes to mind. Ephraim the Syrian spoke Syriac. And so it's a language that's related to Aramaic, sometimes considered a dialect of Aramaic. And he was one of a number of Aramaic-speaking fathers. In addition, like in Egypt, you would find like where the name Shenouda is common. In fact, some of the Coptic popes have been named Shenouda. Coptic is the language there. Coptic is a language that's descended from ancient Egyptian, although it also has like loan words from Greek. I happen to remember that the Coptic word for governor is hegemon, which is from Greek. And so it does have influences from other languages, but it basically is a derivative of ancient Egyptian. There are individuals who are fathers that spoke a bunch of different languages, at least locally. An example would be St. Patrick. Now, St. Patrick was from the west of Britain, of Great Britain, and he may well have spoken Latin, as illustrated by his name, Patricius. He may have been natively a Latin speaker, but when he started ministering in Ireland, he would have naturally spoken in the local languages there. And Ireland was not a Roman colony in the same way that Britain had not been colonized by the Romans in the same way that Britain had been. So there are a variety of different languages in the early church. Latin and Greek are the major ones that most of the fathers wrote in, but there were also a lot of individuals writing and speaking and preaching in other languages as well. Incidentally, Syriac is a big enough language in the early church fathers that there's a series devoted to it. There's a famous collection of writings of church fathers. It's called Minya, after the guy who did it, who compiled them all. And he's got a big Latin set and a big Greek set, and then a somewhat smaller Syriac set.
Mm-hmm.
And so Syriac was popular enough as a language among the church fathers that it even got a special series in kind of the definitive original language collection of the Church Fathers.
Okay, Devante.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very, very much. 888-318-7884 is our number. We go now to Dave in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on EWTN. Dave, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Yes, how are you guys doing? I've got a real simple question, and I'll ask it fast because I know your lines are full. But what is the Catholic Church's view on cremation? From my understanding, that our bodies are going to rise at the end of time. Mm-hmm. Does that affect being cremated? Is that considered a sin? And I'll take my answer offline. I appreciate it.
No problem. So, the human body after death decays, and in the ancient world, at least outside of Egypt, they didn't have a lot of extensive means of preserving it to arrest that decay. Today we do. Today when you bury somebody, you can preserve them pretty well to where – I mean their blood is replaced by formaldehyde, which has a preservative effect, and then they're buried in a coffin that's sealed against the elements. And if you take – a lot of precautions, you can really preserve somebody's body pretty effectively today. Historically, nothing like that happened in most cultures. In fact, in Jesus's own day, what typically happened when someone dies was they would be buried immediately because the decomposition started immediately. So they'd be buried the same day and they'd be placed in a tomb, and then the loved ones would wait a year and come back. And by the time they came back, the flesh would have deteriorated off the bones. And so what they would do then is they would take the bones and clean them and put them in a special bone receptacle, a kind of box known as an ossuary or bone holder. And sometimes they'd write the name of the people who were in the ossuary on the ossuary, so we can get some interesting clues about ancient Jewish society by looking at ossuaries that have survived. But even in Jesus's own day, right there, you had the body basically disintegrate into tiny, tiny little bits. And there was an awareness that this was the natural progression of things from much earlier than that. So, for example, in Genesis, written 1,000 years BC, you have the statement to Adam, dust you are and to dust you shall return. And that reflects an awareness that when somebody dies, their body disintegrates and they return to being part of the material order. At least their body does. And so the fact that our bodies disintegrate is something that has always been known, and it has not stopped people from believing in the resurrection, because even though it would be humanly impossible for us to go find all those little bits and put them together again, just like it's impossible for us after someone is definitively dead to bring them back to life, it's not impossible for God. He's the one who created us in the first place and came up with the universe and the rules by which it operates, and he's omnipotent. He has unlimited power, and therefore it doesn't tax his power in the slightest to reassemble somebody even after they've been totally disintegrated in bodily form. So from a Catholic perspective, the cremation, which just hastens the process of bodily disintegration, is not going to stop God from putting you back together again. And it's not a sin in principle. In fact, it's the normal mode of disposing of the bodies of the dead and treating them reverently in some cultures. So it's not a problem intrinsically. Having said that, there have been people who have said, well, I'm going to make it hard for God. I'm going to get cremated so that, he can't put me back together. Ha ha, I don't believe in the resurrection.
Oh.
And I'm going to do this as a sign of my disbelief in the resurrection. Well, if that's why you're getting cremated, well, then yeah, that is a sin. But the joke's going to be on you because God's going to put you back together anyway.
Dave, how does all of that strike you?
You're going to have to answer for it.
Dave? Oh, he went off air. That's
okay.
Right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
That's he's going to put you back together anyway.
Yep.
Yep. You're not in charge. That's an important spiritual lesson, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're not in charge.
You
is
are
like
not
one of
in
the
charge.
Main things
yeah.
you got to learn. All right. Well, let's go to Well, you know what? Bob in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Bob, I'm going to probably ask you to get the question out, and we'll take the answer on the other side because we're running short of time.
Just thank you, gentlemen. I just like Jimmy's opinion on using the Collegeville Bible Commentary as a Bible resource study.
Yeah. Actually, I may be able to address this adequately before the break. I'm not a big fan of the Collegeville Bible Commentary. It's put out by Liturgical Press in Collegeville, Minnesota. And like a lot of commentaries kind of written in mid-20th century Catholic circles, it has an over-fascination with source criticism. It's too concerned with breaking down biblical documents into the sources that were used to compose them, and it kind of loses sight of the message of the books themselves. Yeah. There also are passages in it where it's questionable. Not only does it use questionable scholarship, but also there are some problematic views that are expressed in some passages that cut against the grain of church teaching. And so I'm not a big fan of it. I'd say at least you want to use critical thinking and be on your guard in using it.
Thanks, Bob. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just trying to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popcheck thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Do you subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine? We hope, but if not, right now we've got a deal that you're going to love. We've reduced the price and thrown in a free digital subscription when you subscribe. That's right, subscriptions to Catholic Answers Magazine just got cheaper, $10 less on one-year subscriptions and $20 less on two-year subscriptions. And right now, when you purchase a subscription, you get a subscription to the digital edition added to your order for free. With a deal like that, it's the perfect gift for friends, family members, seminarians, your priest, even yourself. When you get right down to it, what other gift has the potential to touch hearts and reap eternal rewards? Log on today to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and sign up yourself, your friends, and your family for a magazine that is bound to make a difference in their lives and the lives of those they meet. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our On Fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
That's not it. That's not the groovy music yet, but it is Thursday, so we'll get the groovy music at some point. Open Forum is also part of Thursday. Well, actually, that's what we do on Thursdays is Open Forum. If you have a question about any aspect of the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, you are welcome to give us a call, 888-318-7884. You can be Catholic and call. You can be non-Catholic and call. Everybody's call is welcome. And this hour, we have Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist here at Catholic Answers, addressing those questions. Jimmy.
Yeah.
Oliver in Oneida, New York. Line six. Okay. Oliver,
okay.
I'm sorry. I got confused about something. You're on with Jimmy Akin, Oliver. Your question.
Thank you. And thank you for all you do. I wish you were here 50 years ago.
I was here 50 years ago.
I was just very young.
I couldn't answer any questions yet, but I was here 50 years ago. Sorry, Oliver.
Well, there's scholarship there, and there's been so little of it. Not.
No, I know what you mean.
Church per se, but everywhere. I'm eager to know the date of origin of the doctrine of transubstantiation, and is it practiced outside the Roman Church, or is it exclusively a Roman thing?
Okay. The doctrine of transubstantiation was first taught on April 2nd of AD 33. That's the day before the crucifixion. It's Holy Thursday. Jesus taught this at the Last Supper, where he said, "This is my body and this is my blood." Actually, he'd anticipated this earlier, if you read John chapter 6, which occurred at Passover either 1 or 2 years before that. Jesus himself did teach this. Now, he didn't spell it out in a lot of detail, but he did say, "This is my body and this is my blood." Not "this represents my body," not "this contains my body." He says, "This is my body," and that's what transubstantiation is, the teaching that the bread and wine are converted into being the body and blood of Jesus. So that's when it began to be taught. Now, it was then subsequently continued in the church's teaching. St. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians, which he wrote about AD 53, so about 20 years later. And you can find it further along for example, in the early 2nd century. If you look at the epistles of Ignatius of Antioch, he was the bishop of Antioch, which incidentally had served as Paul's home base for the missionary mm-hmm. journeys. And so the later bishop of Antioch, who had been ordained by the apostles, Ignatius, was being taken to Rome about the year 110 AD. And on his way to Rome, he writes a number of letters to different churches, including the Church of Rome where he's going. And in them, he's very concerned to refute a group of heretics that were around in his day known as Docetists. Docetists took their name from the Greek word dokein, which means to seem. And they claimed that Jesus wasn't really incarnate in the flesh. He only seemed to be a man. Mm. He was really God, but he only seemed to be a man. So he didn't really die on the cross. The Eucharist isn't really his flesh and blood because he didn't have flesh and blood, and so on. It may be this same group or some of them that John the Elder is responding to in 2nd and 3rd John, where he talks about – and in the Johannine literature more broadly – where he talks about people who are antichrist are those who deny that Jesus has come in the flesh.
Oh, okay.
And so that may be a reference to Docetists as well. And one of the things in his epistles that Ignatius of Antioch talks about is the fact that the Docetists won't participate in the Eucharist because they don't confess it to be the body and blood of Jesus. And so you have a strong recognition that that's what it is, and that continues on through the Church Fathers. Now, eventually, the term transubstantiation gets coined. Transubstantiation is a term that reflects a biblical reality, even though the term didn't exist in biblical days. It's kind of like the word Trinity.
Yeah.
The Trinity is a biblical reality, but that word wasn't coined to express the reality of the Trinity until later. And the same thing with transubstantiation. The reality is taught in Scripture, explicitly so by Jesus. But later we get a formal theological term for that reality, and that came along in the Middle Ages. It was defined by the Fourth Lateran Council in the year 1215. And so it had become part of the church's official infallible vocabulary by the early 1200s. In terms of you asked, is it just a Roman thing? Well, no, it's believed by all Catholics, including Catholics who are not Roman Catholics. Roman Catholics are members of the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church, but there are other Catholics too, such as Ukrainian Catholics, Chaldean Catholics, Maronite Catholics, Byzantine Catholics. All of them are in union with the Pope, and they all share the Church's faith in the Eucharist. Outside of the Catholic Church, there are some individuals who believe in transubstantiation in the same way that the Catholic Church does. There are also other people who, even though they don't necessarily dot all the I's and cross all the T's on transubstantiation, and notice there are I's and T's
yeah.
in transubstantiation, they nevertheless have a firm belief in the real presence. And so that's something that's actually some kind of strong belief in the real presence is actually the majority position among the great majority of world Christians. You would, taking into account the different Catholic and Orthodox and Lutheran and Episcopalian, you're upwards of 80 or more percent of world Christians believe in some form of the real presence.
Oliver, how does that strike you?
Well, I'm very wonderful and long overdue and very clear and very concise.
Thank you.
Where do you teach?
Right here.
I teach right here on Catholic Answers Live and on my blog, jimmyakin.com, and wherever I have the opportunity.
Oliver, how about if we send you one of Jimmy's books? We'll send you a daily defense.
Sounds great.
Get those 26 books.
Oh, you want to get the 26? Oh, well, I can't take an order right now. I got to send you to another phone line. But hang on.
We'll put you on hold and get your contact info.
Yeah, let's get your contact info. I want to send you a daily defense. Oliver, thank you so much for that call from New York. 888-318-7884, our number. We go now to Sue in Westerville, Ohio, listening on EWTN. Sue, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi. This question is all... bothered me, and I was wondering if you can tell me why the Jewish people did not accept Christ as the Messiah and therefore did not follow him.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd point out, along with St. Paul, that many of them did. St. Paul, as you know, he points out, in fact, he's got a discussion of this in Romans, if you want to read Romans 9 through 11. He points out that a hardening has come upon the Jewish people in part as part of God's plan to allow space for the in history for the Gentiles to become part of God's people too. Apparently, according to St. Paul, there's a promise from God that when the Jewish people fully accept his son, that it'll be the end of the world and we'll have the resurrection of the dead and so forth. So if they'd all accepted him right then and right there, we would have had the end of the world in the first century, and the Gentiles, like you and me, I assume, would not have had the opportunity to become part of the people of God. In fact, for you and me living here in the 21st century, we wouldn't even have had the chance to exist. So on a theological level, God allowed a hardening to come upon the Jewish people in part so that – or on part of the Jewish people, I should say – so that there would be space in history for the Gentiles to become part of the people of God. On a practical level, on a human level, why didn't many of them accept Jesus? Well, there are a few reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is they had different expectations of what the Messiah would do. It was not commonly expected that the Messiah would be someone who would come and suffer and die and that he would be the Son of God in the sense that Jesus is the Son of God. Instead, it was commonly assumed that the Messiah would be a mortal man who was only Son of God in a kind of honorary sense, like Solomon is in the Psalms. You know, today I begotten you, you were my son. You know, it's addressed to Solomon initially. So he's kind of an adopted son of God. And it was thought that the Messiah would be an adopted son of God who was a human ruler and political revolutionary that would kick out the Romans and establish God's kingdom as a sovereign nation on earth, not a heavenly spiritual kingdom. And so Jesus, when he didn't fulfill those expectations that a lot of people had for who the Messiah would be and what he would do, a lot of people said, well, he's not the Messiah I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they didn't accept him. Also, as part of God's plan, God allowed the Jewish leaders to be instruments in rejecting Jesus. And so the Jewish leaders rejected Jesus. And if the leaders reject somebody, then the people tend to go along with their leaders. So the fact there was institutional opposition to Jesus also helped a lot of people who were Jewish not accept him. Also, the fact that Jesus came from a disreputable environment. I mean, Galilee was this rural area where you had a bunch of people who were basically viewed by sophisticates as a bunch of hicks. And, you know, when Peter and John appear before the Sanhedrin, the ruling council in Jerusalem in the book of Acts, it notes that they are agrammatoi, which is Greek for unlettered or illiterate mm-hmm. men. Some people have said, well, that just didn't mean they couldn't read. It just means they weren't educated.
Yeah.
It also could mean they didn't know how to read at this point in their ministry. But either way, they're viewed as a bunch of low-life, lower-class people. And the fact that Jesus associated with the poor and used poor people like these Galilean fishermen as his ministers, also that choice on Jesus's part to associate with the poor meant that a lot of opinion leaders, a lot of upper-class, what we would today call influencers,
yeah.
weren't going to be interested.
People with a lot of followers on Twitter.
Exactly. And yeah. so St. Paul says that not many of you, even to the Corinthians who are mostly Gentiles, he says not many of you are wise in the world's eyes because of this, because Christianity didn't have as much of that upper class following in the beginning. So all of those were factors that contributed to why many Jewish people didn't accept Jesus. But even in his own day, some of them did. Jesus' own immediate followers obviously accepted him. St. Peter, St. John, St. Andrew, St. Paul, all of those people did. He also had crowds of thousands of people who were following him at least some of the time during his ministry, like when he fed the 5,000. And some have actually argued that even though the mission to the Jewish people may not have been successful or completely successful in Jesus's own day, that it later, in later centuries, actually came to be much more successful, and that that even a majority of the Jewish population may have converted to Christianity in later centuries, even though that was something that took a while to happen.
Okay, Sue.
Okay, but I have a question.
Okay, what's your question?
And so, I mean, history has proven differently, and it's a question in my mind why Jewish people haven't seen that and become Christian.
Oh, okay. So that's a different question, and you're right. It is.
Yeah, that's
really- yeah. So, well, there have been Jewish people down through history who have become Christian. One of our former apologists here at Catholic Answers, then known as Rosalind Moss, now known as Mother Miriam, was a Jewish convert to the Christian faith. In the Middle Ages, there were actually three different popes who came from Jewish families. So there have been Jewish people who become Christian down through the ages. But one big reason – now, there are a number of reasons. One is that religion is a conservative force, and most people tend to remain the religion they're born into. And that's true of Jewish people just like it is other people. But also, there's been hostility between Jews and Christians down through the ages. There has been – and as a result of that hostility, whenever there's hostility between two groups of people, they start drawing up lines and getting insulated with regard to each other, and our native tribal instincts, which we all have, kick in to reinforce group solidarity and minimize defections from the group. And so because the Jewish people, particularly in Europe – but also elsewhere in the Middle East, for example, were a persecuted minority, they naturally had a strong sense of group identity that minimized and they consciously sought to minimize defections from the group, just like other groups do. And so that is one of the reasons that Jewish people down through history have been reluctant to becoming Christian or other things. The memory of the hostilities and the Christian anti-Semitism in history has posed a significant barrier.
Sue, thank you for those questions. Jimmy, before we go to the break, have you ever had the thought where you wonder, like, say you had been a Sadducee or a Pharisee in Jesus' day, how would you have
this
responded?
This is not my fantasy life, dude.
No, you've never thought about that?
Not so much.
I always wonder that. Like, uh-huh. Would I have recognized them, or would I have been one of the...
I could only hope and pray that I would be in the same camp as Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea.
Yeah. Right, right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Today, our faith is under attack like never before. Skeptics of all stripes are trying to undermine the very basis of our faith. Some critics argue that Jesus never even existed, and they've influenced tens of millions of people. Others have argued that even if Jesus existed, we can't trust the New Testament as history. No wonder so many people today doubt their faith or have lost it altogether. The good news is that there are answers to each and every one of their charges. That's why Catholic Answers Studios has just released a new DVD by Jimmy Akin titled The Dawn of Christian History. It's a powerful presentation in which Jimmy takes on the skeptics and refutes them point by point, showing you how even tiny details that you've never noticed all show how the New Testament is a faithful historical record. To make your donation and get a free copy of The Dawn of Christian History, visit Catholic.com and click the Dawn of Christian History banner, or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the Dawn of Christian History banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into, or back to, the practice of the Catholic faith. This Lent, plant seeds of faith in the hearts and minds of your non-Catholic friends and family. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today. You can order your copies of Why We're Catholic by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It is Thursday, and Thursday means open forum. Any question that you have on the Catholic faith, we're happy to take that call, 888-318-7884. Taking your calls this hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And let's move along through these questions because we got a whole bunch of them. Moro in Pembroke Pines, Florida, a bright man listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, which you can get for your iPhone or Android phone. Moro, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Jimmy and Cy. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Okay.
Awesome. I haven't called in a while. I miss you guys, but I've been listening.
Thank you.
So my question is, I'm a South Florida native. Mm-hmm. I've been born and raised here my whole life. And, of course, we just went through that horrible tragedy at Stoneman Gutless with the shooting.
Yeah, we had a similar one here near the Catholic Answers office a few years ago. So our hearts go out to you.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So, you know, of course, there's been a knee-jerk reaction. You know, a lot of people have been protesting, and of course, there's a lot of anti-firearm sentiments. And basically, my question is what is the Catholic response to this? Because I know that we are entitled the right to self-defense and to own firearms in our homes, and I feel like people are seeking a solution solely through policy change. But I feel like they're looking at the symptoms, but they're not really looking at the disease. Mm-hmm. You know, like 30 years ago, these things didn't happen, you know, and people used to, you know, used to have rifle clubs and people used to bring their guns to school, and these atrocities never happened. So how do we respond to this other than just enacting policy change, but rather looking at the real disease, not just the overlying symptoms that, of course, it's very difficult to have this conversation with a mother who just lost her kid. But from a logical perspective, from a fact-based perspective, like, how do we respond?
Okay, Mauro, thank you.
Well, it's a very difficult and sensitive subject. And the first thing I would say is that we need to distinguish a few things. One of them, now you mentioned we have a right to self-defense. That's true. Different states have formulate that right differently in their local law codes. But underlying all of those, there is a natural right to self-defense that's part of universal moral law that we all have. And that's something that the church acknowledges. That's why if someone's attacking you and the only way to save your life or to save the lives of others is to take that person's life, then that's a form of legitimate defense. And that's discussed in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. You also said we have a right to firearms or to bear arms. That's a right that is granted by the United States Constitution. It's in the Bill of Rights. It's obviously the famous Second Amendment. But it's not necessarily the case that we have a natural law right to have firearms. In fact, firearms are a relatively recent invention. Gunpowder, you know, didn't become common in Europe until the late Middle Ages. And so firearms really were not around until that point. And one could argue that we have some kind of natural law right to the kind of means of self-defense that we're likely to need in a given situation, given the threats that we face. But that may or may not cash out into a concrete right to any particular type of weapon. Certainly, it wouldn't cash out to a particular type of weapon in every single age, because the threats you're going to face are going to be different. So we need to recognize that the right to bear arms, specifically arms meaning firearms, the right to bear arms is a U.S. civil right, not simply a natural law right the way the right to self-defense is. Having made that distinction, the Catholic Church doesn't have a specific teaching on the question of firearms or gun control or anything like this. You won't find a mention in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for example. You will find occasional magisterial statements that condemn weapons trafficking between, you know, like trouble zones and rebellions and things like that. But the Church doesn't have a specific policy here. And so there's a broad range of legitimate opinion among Catholics regarding what kind of policy regarding firearms should be adopted. And that's something that can even vary from nation to nation because cultural conditions, economic conditions, there are a variety of conditions that affect the use of firearms that can be different from one nation to another and even from one time to another. As you mentioned, certainly, you know, 30 years ago when I was in high school, they did have gun clubs. They had classes, you know, in marksmanship and stuff that you could take at high school, and it was a very normal thing. And you certainly didn't hear reports of these kinds of shootings. Whether they never happened, that's something that I don't know that I'd go that far. Certainly, they didn't receive the kind of obsessive, you know, coverage that they do now in the media. And that coverage may itself fuel copycat incidents. So, you know, there's reason for concern there. But obviously, the church would want to find ways and would want people, including the laity and the politicians that represent us, to find appropriate ways to effectively address the issue of violence in our society, whether it's this kind of horrific shooting situation or whether violence is being manifested in other forms like organized crime and murder suicides and all kinds of different things, even if they're not mass shootings. There are a lot of different types of violence and they all need to be addressed. And the church would certainly, Mauro, endorse your approach of not simply trying to regulate things on the policy level, but also on the what you might call the end of line policy level, but also on the deeper level of what's producing these things in society. For example, with the recent school shooting, apparently the gentleman who committed it seemed to have a history of mental problems and seems to have made no secret of his violent tendencies and his desire to do this. And yet mental health and school and law enforcement officials didn't take those signals seriously. So there could certainly be room there for improvement.
Yeah.
But as I say, the church doesn't have a teaching in this area, and it's really up to the laity to figure out the best solutions for any particular society, addressing not only the symptoms of a problem, but the causes of that problem as well.
Mauro, thank you very, very much for that call. You can hear the music, so we will have to leave it there. It's striking to me, Jimmy, that one of the things I wonder if we talk about enough is, as you said, the role of the media in this, you know, kind of turning these things into TV shows that go on.
Well,
and on
there's that saying, if it bleeds, it leads, which is horrific when you think of that being applied to a situation like this and how it can spawn copycats.
Right. Exactly. Jimmy Akin, thank you for another fine hour on Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum.
Thank you, Cy Kellett.
And don't forget, you can get Jimmy's books at shop.catholic.com. And among them are his two 20 Answers books. And all the 20 Answers books are on sale for 60% off right now. And shipping is free. Just go to shop.catholic.com. Next hour, Father Paul Keller will be here with us to answer your questions on any aspect of the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.